Tangi. After something of a tug-of-war, and only by jumping vigorously on a couple of the lower branches, was I able to tear them free at last. 5 minutes later, at the centre of the glade, I had gathered enough twigs and branches to have the makings of a decent campfire. Hopefully, while muttering the girl guide's prayer, "Burn, blast you!" I lit one of the matches I had found in the caravan's locker. As the flame touched the twigs, it sizzled and went out. Another did the same. As I am not noted for my patience, I let slip a mild curse. "If I were at home in my chemical laboratory," I thought, "I would be doing as any civilized person does, and using a Bunsen burner to boil water for tea, not messing about on my knees in a clearing with a bundle of stupid green twigs." It was true that, before my rather abrupt departure from the girl guides, I had learned to start campfires, but I'd vowed that never again would I be caught dead trying to make a fire bow from a stick and a shoestring, or rubbing two dry sticks together like a demented squirrel. As noted, I had all the ingredients of a roaring fire. All, that is, except one. "Wherever there are paraffin lamps," I thought, "paraffin cannot be far away." I let down the hinged side panel of the caravan, and there, to my delight, was a gallon of the stuff. I unscrewed the cap of the tin, splashed a bit of it onto the waiting firewood, and before you could say Baden Powell, the tea kettle was at a merry boil. I was proud of myself, I really was. "Flavia the resourceful," I was thinking. "Flavia, the all-round good girl." That sort of thing. Up the steep steps of the caravan I climbed, tea in hand, balancing on my toes like a tightrope walker. I handed the cup to the gypsy and watched as she sipped at the steaming liquid. "You were quick about it," she said. I shrugged humbly. No need to tell her about the paraffin. "You found dry sticks in the locker?" she asked. "No," I said, "I..." Her eyes grew wide with horror, and she held out the cup at arm's length. "Not the bushes! You didn't cut the elder bushes!" "Why, yes," I said modestly. "It was no trouble at all. The cup flew from her hands with a clatter, and scalding tea went flying in all directions. She leapt from the bunk with startling speed and shrank herself back into the corner. "Hilda Muir!" she cried in an eerie and desolate wail that rose and fell like an air raid siren. "Hilda Muir!" she was pointing to the door. I turned to look, but no one was there. "Get away from me! Get out! Get out!" Her hand trembled like a dead leaf. I stood there, dumbfounded. What had I done?
"Oh, God! Hilda Muir, we are all dead," she groaned. "Now we are all dead."
Chapter 3. Seen from the rear, at the edge of the ornamental lake, Buckshaw presented an aspect seldom seen by anyone other than family. Although the tall brick wall of the kitchen garden hid some parts of the house, there were two upper rooms, one at the end of each wing, that seemed to rise up above the landscape like twin towers in a fairy tale. At the southwest corner was Harriet's boudoir, an airless preserve that was kept precisely as it had been on that terrible day 10 years ago when news of her tragic death had reached Buckshaw. In spite of the Italian lace that hung at its windows, the room inside was a curiously sanitized preserve as if, like the British Museum, it had a team of silent grey-clad scrubbers who came in the night to sweep away all signs of passing time, such as cobwebs or dust. Although I thought it unlikely, my sisters believed that it was Father who was the keeper of Harriet's shrine. Once, hiding on the stairs, I had overheard Feely telling Daffy, "He cleans in the night to atone for his sins." "Bloodstains and the like," Daffy had whispered dramatically. Far too agog for sleep, I had lain in bed for hours, open-eyed and wondering what she meant. Now, at the southeast corner of the house, the upstairs windows of my chemical laboratory reflected the slow passage of the clouds as they drifted across the dark glass like fat sheep in a blue meadow, giving no hint to the outside world of the pleasure palace that lay within. I looked up at the panes happily, hugging myself, visualizing the array of gleaming glassware that awaited my pleasure. The indulgent father of my great-uncle Tarquin de Luce had built the laboratory for his son during the reign of Queen Victoria. Uncle Tar had been sent down from Oxford amid some sort of scandal that had never been quite fully explained, at least in my presence, and it was here at Buckshaw that he began his glorious, if cloistered, chemical career. After Uncle Tar's death, the laboratory was left to keep its secrets to itself, locked and forgotten by people who were more concerned with taxes and drainage than with cunningly shaped vessels of glass. Until I came along, that is, and claimed it for my own. I wrinkled my nose in pleasure at the memory. As I approached the kitchen door, I felt proud of myself to have thought of using the least conspicuous entrance. With Daffy and Feely forever scheming and plotting against me, one could never be too careful. But the excitement of the fete and the moving of the gypsies' caravan to the Parlings had caused me to miss lunch. Right now, even a slice of Mrs. Mullet's stomach-churning cabbage cake would probably be bearable, if taken with a glass of ice-cold milk to freeze the taste buds. By this late in the afternoon, Mrs. M. would have gone home for the day, and I would have the kitchen to myself. I opened the door and stepped inside. "Got you," said a grating voice at my ear, and everything went dark as a sack was pulled over my head. I struggled, but it did no good. My hands and arms were useless as the mouth of the sack was tied tightly about my thighs. Before I could scream, my assailants, of whom I was quite sure there were two, judging by the number of hands that were grabbing at my limbs, turned me head over heels. Now I was upside down, standing on my head, with someone grasping my ankles. I was suffocating, fighting for breath, my lungs filled with the sharp, earthy smell of the potatoes that had recently occupied the sack. I could feel the blood rushing to my head. Damn! I should have thought sooner of kicking them. Too late now.
"Make all the noise you want," hissed a second voice. "There's no one here to save you."
With a sinking feeling, I realized that this was true. Father had gone up to London to a philatelic auction, and Dogger had gone with him to shop for secateurs and boot polish. The idea of burglars inside Buckshaw was unthinkable. That left Daffy and Feely. In an odd way, I wished it had been burglars. I recalled that in the entire house there was only one doorknob that squeaked, the door to the cellar stairs. It squeaked now. A moment later, like a shot deer, I was being hoisted up onto the shoulders of my captors and roughly borne, head first, down into the cellars. At the bottom of the stairs they dumped me heavily onto the flagstones, banging my elbow, and I heard my own voice shrieking with pain as it came echoing back from the vaulted ceilings, followed by the sound of my own ragged breathing. Someone's shoes shifted in the grit not far from where I lay sprawled.
"Pray silence," croaked a hollow voice, which sounded artificial, like that of a tin robot.
I let out another shriek, and I'm afraid I might even have whimpered a little.
"Pray silence!"
Whether it was from the sudden shock or the clammy coldness of the cellars, I could not be certain, but I had begun to shiver. Would they take this as a sign of weakness? It is said that in certain small animals it is instinctive when in danger to play dead, and I realized that I was one of them. I took shallow breaths and tried not to move a muscle.
"Free her, Garbax." "Yes, oh, three-eyed one."
It sometimes amused my sisters to slip suddenly into the roles of bizarre alien creatures, creatures even more bizarre and alien than they were already in everyday life. Both of them knew it was a trick that for some reason I found particularly upsetting. I had already learned that Sisterhood, like Loch Ness, has things that lurk unseen beneath the surface, but I think it was only now that I realized that of all the invisible strings that tied the three of us together, the dark ones were the strongest.
"Stop it, Daffy! Stop it, Feely!" I shouted. "You're frightening me!"
I gave my legs a couple of convincing frog-like kicks, as if I were on the verge of a seizure. The sack was suddenly whisked away, spinning me round so that I now lay face down upon the stones. A single candle, stuck to the top of a wooden cask, flickered fitfully, its pale light sending dark shapes dancing everywhere among the stone arches of the cellar. As my eyes became accustomed to the gloom, I saw my sisters' faces looming grotesquely in the shadows. They had drawn black circles round their eyes and their mouths with burnt cork, and I understood instantly the message which this was intended to convey. "Beware, you are in the hands of savages!" Now I could see the cause of the distorted robot voice I had heard. Feely had been speaking into the mouth of an empty cocoa tin.
"French jet is nothing but glass,"
she spat, chucking the tin to the floor, where it fell with a nerve-wracking clatter.
"Your very words. What have you done with Mummy's brooch?"
"It was an accident," I whined untruthfully. Feely's frozen silence lent me a bit of confidence. "I dropped it and stepped on it. If it were real jet, it mightn't have shattered."
"Hand it over."
"I can't, Feely. There was nothing left but little chips. I melted them down for slag." Actually, I had hit the thing with a hammer and reduced it to black sand.
"Slag? Whatever do you want with slag?"
It would be a mistake to tell her that I was working on a new kind of ceramic flask, one that would stand up to the temperatures produced by a super-oxygenated Bunsen burner.
"Nothing," I said. "I was just mucking about."
"Oddly enough, I believe you," Feely said. "That's what you pixie changelings do best, isn't it? Muck about."
My puzzlement must have been evident on my face.
"Changelings," Daffy said in a weird voice. "The pixies come in the night and steal a healthy baby from its crib. They leave an ugly, shriveled changeling like you in its place, and the mother desolate."
"If you don't believe it," Feely said, "go stand in front of a looking glass."
"I'm not a changeling," I protested, my anger rising. "Harriet loved me more than she did either of you two morons."
"Did she?" Feely sneered. "Then why did she used to leave you sleeping in front of an open window every night, hoping that the pixies would bring back the real Flavia?"
"She didn't," I shouted.
"I'm afraid she did. I was there. I saw. I remember."
"No, it's not true."
"Yes, it is. I used to cling to her and cry, 'Mummy, Mummy, please make the pixies bring back my baby sister.'"
"Flavia? Daphne? Ophelia?"
It was Father. His voice came at parade square volume from the direction of the kitchen staircase, amplified by the stone walls and echoing from arch to arch. All three of our heads snapped round just in time to see his boots, his trousers, his upper body, and finally his face come into sight as he descended the stairs.
"What's the meaning of this?" he asked,
peering round at the three of us in the near darkness.
"What have you done to yourselves?"
With the backs of their hands and their forearms, Feely and Daffy were already trying to scrub the black markings from their faces.
"We were only playing prawns and trivets,"
Daffy said before I could answer. She pointed accusingly at me.
"She gives us jolly good what for when it's her turn to play the Begum, but when it's ours, she's always..."
Well done, Daff, I thought. I couldn't have concocted a better spur-of-the-moment excuse myself.
"I'm surprised at you, Ophelia," Father said. "I shouldn't have thought..."
and then he stopped, unable to find the required words. There were times when he seemed almost, what was it? Afraid of my older sister? Feely rubbed at her face, smearing her cork makeup horribly. I nearly laughed out loud, but then I realized what she was doing. In a bid for sympathy, she was spreading the stuff to create dark, theatrical circles under her eyes. The vixen, like an actress applying her makeup on stage. It was a bold and brazen performance, which I couldn't help admiring. Father looked on in thrall, like a man fascinated by a cobra.
"Are you all right, Flavia?"
he said at last, not budging from his position on the third step from the bottom.
"Yes, Father,"
I said.
I was going to add, "Thank you for asking," but I stopped myself just in time. I didn't want to overdo it.
Father looked slowly from one of us to another with his sad eyes, as if there were no words left in the world from which to choose.
"There will be a parley at 7 o'clock, he said at last, "in the drawing room."
With a final glance at each of us, he turned and trudged slowly up the stairs.
"The thing of it is," Father was saying, "you girls just don't seem to understand."
And he was right. We no more understood his world than he did ours. His was a world of confetti, a brightly coloured universe of royal profiles and scenic views on sticky bits of paper. A world of pyramids and battleships, of rickety suspension bridges in far-flung corners of the globe, of deep harbours, lonely watchtowers, and the heads of famous men. In short, Father was a stamp collector, or a philatelist, as he preferred to call himself, and to be called by others. His every waking moment was spent in peering through a magnifying lens at paper scraps in an eternal search for flaws. The discovery of a single microscopic crack in a printing plate, which had resulted in an unwanted hair on Queen Victoria's chin, could send him into raptures. First would come the official photograph and elation. He would bring out of storage and set up on its tripod in his study an ancient plate camera with a peculiar attachment called a macroscopic lens, which allowed him to take a close-up of the specimen. This, when developed, would produce an image large enough to fill an entire page of a book. Sometimes, as he fussed happily over these operations, we would catch snatches of HMS Pinafore or the Gondoliers drifting like fugitives through the house. Then would come the written paper, which he would submit to the London Philatelist or such like, and with it would come a certain crankiness. Every morning, Father would bring to the breakfast table reams of writing paper, which he would fill, page after laborious page, with his minuscule handwriting. For weeks he would be unapproachable, and would remain so until such time as he had scribbled the last word, and more, on the topic of the Queen's superfluous whisker. Once, when we were lying on the south lawn looking up into the blue vault of a perfect summer sky, I had suggested to Feely that Father's quest for imperfections was not limited to stamps, but was sometimes expanded to include his daughters.
"Shut your filthy mouth," she'd snapped.
"The thing of it is," Father repeated, bringing me back to the present, "you girls don't appear to understand the gravity of the situation."
Mainly he meant me.
Feely had ratted, of course, and the story of how I had vaporized one of Harriet's dreadful Victorian brooches had come tumbling out of her mouth as happily as the waters of a babbling brook.
"You had no right to remove it from your mother's dressing room," Father said,
and for a moment his cold blue stare was shifted to my sister.
"I'm sorry," Feely said. "I was going to wear it to church on Sunday to impress Dieter. It was quite wrong of me. I should have asked permission." It was quite wrong of me? Had I heard what I thought I'd heard, or were my ears playing hob with me?
it was more likely that the sun and the moon should suddenly dance a jolly jig in the heavens than that one of my sisters should apologize.
It was simply unheard of.
The Dieter Feely had mentioned was Dieter Schranz of Culverhouse Farm, a former German prisoner of war who had chosen to remain behind in England after the armistice. Feely had him in her sights.
Yes, Father said, you should have.
As he turned his attention to me, I could not help noticing that the folds of skin at the outer corners of his hooded eyes, those folds that I so often thought of as making him look so aristocratic, were hanging more heavily than usual, giving him a look of deeper sadness than I had ever seen.
Flavia,
he said in a flat and weary voice that wounded me more than a pointed weapon.
Yes, sir.
What is to be done with you?
I'm sorry, Father. I didn't mean to break the brooch. I dropped it and stepped on it by accident and it just crumbled. Gosh, it must have been very old to be so brittle.
He gave an almost imperceptible wince, followed instantly by one of those looks that meant I had touched upon a topic that was not open for discussion. With a long sigh, he shifted his gaze to the window. Something in my words had sent his mind fleeing to safety beyond the hills.
Did you have an enjoyable trip up to London?
I ventured. To the philatelic exhibition, I mean. The word philatelic drew him back quickly.
I hope you found some decent stamps for your collection.
He let out another sigh, this one frighteningly like a death rattle.
I did not go to London to buy stamps, Flavia. I went there to sell them.
Even Feely gasped.
Our days at Buckshaw may be drawing to a close,
Father said.
As you are well aware, the house itself belonged to your mother, and when she died without leaving a will.
He spread his hands in a gesture of helplessness that reminded me of a stricken butterfly. He had deflated so suddenly in front of us that I could scarcely believe it.
I had hoped to take her brooch to someone whom I know.
For quite a few moments his words did not register. I knew that in recent years the cost of maintaining Buckshaw had become positively ruinous, to say nothing of the taxes and the looming death duty. For years Father had managed to keep the snarling taxmen, as he called them, at bay. But now the wolves must be howling once again on the doorstep. There had been hints from time to time of our predicament, but the threat had always seemed unreal, no more than a distant cloud on a summer horizon. I remembered that for a time, Father had pinned his hopes on Aunt Felicity, his sister who lived in Hampstead. Daffy had suggested that many of his so-called philatelic jaunts were, in fact, calls upon Aunt Felicity to touch her for a loan, or to beg her to fork over whatever remained of the family jewels. In the end, his sister must have turned him down. Just recently, and with our own ears, we had heard her tell him he must think about selling his philatelic collection.
Those ridiculous postage stamps, she had called them, to be precise. Something will turn up, Daffy remarked brightly. It always does.
Only in Dickens, Daphne, Father said. Only in Dickens.
Daffy had been reading David Copperfield for the umpteenth time.
Boning up on pawn shops, she had answered when I asked her why.
Only now did it occur to me that Father had intended to take Harriet's brooch, the one I had destroyed, to a pawnbroker.
May I be excused? I asked.
I'm suddenly not feeling well. It was true. I must have fallen asleep the instant my head touched the pillow. Now, hours later, I was suddenly awake. The hands of my alarm clock, which I had carefully dabbed with my own formulation of phosphorescent paint, told me that it was several minutes past 2 in the morning. I lay in bed, watching the dark shadows of the trees as they twitched restlessly on the ceiling. Ever since the territorial dispute between 2 of my distant ancestors had ended in a bitter stalemate, and a black line painted in the middle of the foyer, this wing of the house had remained unheated. Time and the weather had taken their toll, causing the wallpaper of nearly every room, mine was mustard yellow with scarlet worms, to peel away in great sheets which hung in forlorn flaps, while the paper from the ceiling hung down in great loose swags whose contents were probably best not thought about. Sometimes, especially in winter, I liked to pretend that I lived beneath an iceberg in an Arctic sea, that the coldness was no more than a dream, and that when I awoke, there would be a roaring fire in the rusty fireplace and hot steam rising from the tin hip bath that stood in the corner behind the door. There never was, of course, but I couldn't really complain. I slept here by choice, not by necessity. Here in the east wing, the so-called tar wing of Buckshaw, I could work away to my heart's content until all hours in my chemical laboratory. Since they face south and east, my windows could be ablaze with light and no one outside would see them. No one, that is, except perhaps the foxes and badgers that inhabited the island and the ruined folly in the middle of the ornamental lake, or perhaps the occasional poacher whose footprints and discarded shell casings I sometimes found in my rambles through the parlings. The parlings! I had almost forgotten! My abduction at the kitchen door by Feely and Daffy, my subsequent imprisonment in the cellars, my shaming at the hands of Father, and finally my fatigue, all of those had conspired to make me put the gypsy clean out of my mind. I leaped from my bed, somewhat surprised to find myself still fully clothed. I must have been tired. Shoes in hand, I crept down the great curving staircase to the foyer, where I stopped to listen in the middle of that vast expanse of black and white tiling. To an observer in one of the galleries above, I must have looked like a pawn in some grand and gothic game of chess. A pawn? Pfft, Flavia, admit it. Surely something more than a pawn. The house was in utter silence. Father and Feely, I knew, would be dreaming their respective dreams. Father of perforated bits of paper, and Feely of living in a castle built entirely of mirrors in which she could see herself reflected again and again from every possible aspect. Upstairs, at the far end of the west wing, Daffy would still be awake, though, goggling by candlelight, as she loved to do, at the Gustave Doré engravings in Gargantua and Pantagruel. I had found the fat, calf-bound volume hidden under her mattress while rifling her room in search of a packet of chewing gum that an American serviceman had given to Feely, who had come across him sitting on a stile one morning as she was walking into the village to post a letter. His name was Carl, and he was from St. Louis, in America. He told her she was the spitting image of Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet. Feely, of course, had come home preening and hidden the gum, as she always does with such tributes, in her lingerie drawer, from which Daffy had pinched it, and I, in my turn, from her. For weeks afterward it was Carl this and Carl that, with Feely prattling endlessly on about the muddy Mississippi, its length, its twists and bends, and how to spell it properly without making a fool of oneself. We were given the distinct impression that she had personally conceived and executed the formation of that great river, with God standing helplessly on the sidelines, little more than a plumber's assistant. I smiled at the thought. It was at that precise instant that I heard it, a metallic click. For a couple of heartbeats I stood perfectly still, trying to decide from which direction it had come. The drawing room, I thought, and immediately began tiptoeing in that direction. In my bare feet, I was able to move in perfect silence, keeping an ear out for the slightest sound. Although there are times when I have cursed the painfully acute sense of hearing I've inherited from Harriet, this was not one of them. As I moved at a snail's pace along the corridor, a crack of light suddenly appeared beneath the drawing-room door.
Who could be in there at this time of night? I wondered.
Whoever it was, it certainly wasn't a Deluse. Should I call for help, or tackle the intruder myself? I seized the knob, turned it ever so slowly, and opened the door. A foolhardy action, I suppose, but after all, I was in my own home. No sense in letting Daffy or Feely take all the credit for catching a burglar. Accustomed to the darkness, my eyes were somewhat dazzled by the light of an ancient paraffin lamp that was kept for use during electrical interruptions, and so at first I didn't see anyone there. In fact, it took a moment for me to realize that someone, a stranger in rubber boots, was crouched by the fireplace, his hand on one of the brass fire dogs that had been cast into the shape of foxes. The whites of his eyes flashed as he looked up into the mirror and saw me standing behind him in the open doorway. His moleskin coat and his scarlet scarf flared out as he came to his feet and spun quickly round.
"Crikey, gal, you might have given me a heart attack."
It was Brookie Harewood. Chapter 4. The man had been drinking. I noticed that at once. Even from where I stood, I could detect the smell of alcohol. That and the powerful fishy odour that accompanies a person who wears a creel with as much pride as another might wear a kilt and sporran. I closed the door quietly behind me.
"What are you doing here?" I asked, putting on my sternest face.
Actually, what I was thinking was that Buckshaw, in the small hours of the morning, was becoming a virtual Paddington station. It wasn't more than a couple of months since I had found Horace Bonepenny in a heated nocturnal argument with Father. Well, Bonepenny was now in his grave, and yet here was another intruder to take his place. Brookie raised his cap and tugged at his forelock, the ancient signal of submission to one's better. If he were a dog, it would be much the same thing as prostrating himself and rolling over to expose his belly.
"Answer me, please," I said. "What are you doing here?"
He fiddled a bit with the wicker creel on his hip before he replied.
"You caught me fair and square, miss," he said, shooting me a disarming smile. I noticed, much to my annoyance, that he had perfect teeth. "But I didn't mean no harm. I'll admit I was on the estate, hoping to do a bit of business rabbit-wise. Nothing like a pot of nice rabbit stew for a weak chest, is there?" He knocked his ribcage with a clenched fist and forced a cough that, since I had done it so often myself, didn't fool me for an instant. Neither did his fake gamekeeper dialect. If, as Mrs. Mullet claimed, Brookie's mother was a society artist, he had probably been schooled at Eton or some such place. The grubbing voice was meant to gain him sympathy. That, too, was an old trick. I had used it myself, and because of that, I found myself resenting it.
"The Colonel's no shooter," he went on, "and all the world knows that for a fact. So where's the harm in ridding the place of a pest that does no more than eat your garden and dig holes in your shrubbery? Where's the harm in that, eh?" I noticed that he was repeating himself, almost certainly a sign that he was lying. I didn't know the answer to his question, so I remained silent, my arms crossed. "But then I saw a light inside the house," he went on.
"Hello," I said to myself. "What's this, then, Brookie? Who could be up at this ungodly hour?" I said. "Could someone be sick? I know the Colonel doesn't use a motor car, you see," and then I thought, "What if someone's needed to run into the village to fetch the doctor?"
There was truth in what he said. Harriet's ancient Rolls Royce, a Phantom II, was kept in the coach house as a sort of private chapel, a place that both Father and I went, though never at the same time, of course, whenever we wanted to escape what Father called the vicissitudes of daily life. What he meant, of course, was Daffy and Feely, and sometimes me. Although Father missed Harriet dreadfully, he never spoke of her. His grief was so deep that Harriet's name had been put at the top of the Buckshaw blacklist, things that were never to be spoken of if you valued your life. I confess that Brookie's words caught me off guard. Before I could frame a reply, he went on. But then I thought, no, there's more to it than that. If someone was sick at Buckshaw, there'd be more lights on than one. There'd be lights in the kitchen, someone heating water, someone dashing about. We might have used the telephone, I protested, instinctively resisting Brookie's attempt to spin a web. But he had a point. Father loathed the telephone and allowed it to be used only in the most extreme emergencies. At 2:30 in the morning, it would be quicker to cycle or even run into Bishop's Lacey than to arouse Miss Runciman at the telephone exchange and ask her to ring up the sleeping Dr. Darby. By the time that tedious game of button, button, who's got the button had been completed, we might all of us be dead. As if he were the squire and I the intruder, Brookie, his rubber-booted feet spread wide and his hands clasped behind him, had now taken up a stance in front of the fireplace, midway between the two brass foxes that had belonged to Harriet's grandfather. He didn't lean an elbow on the mantel, but he might as well have. Before I could say another word, he gave a quick, nervous glance to the right and to the left and dropped his voice to a husky whisper. But wait, Brookie, old man, I thought. Hold on, Brookie, old chum. Mightn't this be the famous Grey Lady of Buckshaw that you're seeing? After all, miss, everyone knows that there's sometimes light seen hereabouts that have no easy explanation. Grey Lady of Buckshaw? I'd never heard of such an apparition. How laughably superstitious these villagers were. Did the man take me for a fool? Or is the family spectre not mentioned in polite company? Family spectre? I had the sudden feeling that someone had tossed a bucket of ice water over my heart. Could the Grey Lady of Buckshaw be the ghost of my mother, Harriet? Brookie laughed. Silly thought, wasn't it? He went on. No spooks for me, thank you very much. More likely a housebreaker with his eye on the Colonel's silver. Lots of that going on nowadays, since the war. I think you'd better go now, I said, my voice trembling. Father's a light sleeper. If he wakes up and finds you here, there's no telling what he'll do. He sleeps with his service revolver on the night table. Well, I'll be on my way then, Brookie said casually. Glad to know the family's come to no harm. We worry about you lot, you know, all of us down in the village. No telling what can happen when you're way out here, cut off, as it were. Thank you, I said. We're very grateful, I'm sure. And now, if you don't mind. I unlocked one of the French doors and opened it wide. Good night, miss, he said, and with a grin, he vanished into the darkness. I counted slowly to 10. And then I followed him. Brookie was nowhere in sight. The shadows had swallowed him whole. I stood listening for a few moments on the terrace, but the night was eerily silent. Overhead, the stars twinkled like a million little lanterns, and I recognized a constellation called the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, named for the family of girls in Greek mythology, who were so saddened by their father's fate. He was the famous Atlas, who was doomed to carry the heavens on his shoulders, that they committed suicide. I thought of the rain-swept afternoon I had spent in the greenhouse with Dogger, helping him cut the eyes from a small mountain of potatoes, and listening to a tale that had been handed down by word of mouth for thousands of years. "What a stupid thing to do," I said. Why would they kill themselves?
The Greeks are a dramatic race, Dogger had answered.
They invented the drama.
How do you know all these things?
They swim in me head, he said, like dolphins. And then he lapsed into his customary silence. Somewhere across the lawn, an owl hooted, bringing me back with a start to the present. I realized that I was still holding my shoes in my hand. What a fool I must have looked to Brookie Harewood. Behind me, except for the paraffin lamp that still burned in the drawing room, Buckshaw was all in darkness. It was too early for breakfast and too late to go back to bed. I stepped back into the house, put on my shoes, and turned down the wick. By now, the gypsy woman would be rested and be over her fright. With any luck, I could manage an invitation to a gypsy breakfast over an open campfire. And with a bit more luck, I might even find out who Hilda Muir was and why we were all dead. I paused at the edge of the palings, waiting for my eyes to become accustomed to the deeper gloom among the trees. A wooded glade in darkness is an eerie place, I thought, a place where almost anything could happen. Pixies? Hilda Muir? The Grey Lady of Buckshaw? I gave myself a mental shake. Stop it, Flavia, a voice inside me said, and I took its advice. The caravan was still there. I could see several stars and a patch of the Milky Way reflected in one of its curtain windows. The sound of munching somewhere in the darkness told me that Gry was grazing not far away. I approached the caravan slowly. Hello, I sang, keeping the tone light, in view of the gypsy's earlier frame of mind. It's me, Flavia. Knock, knock. Anyone at home? There was no reply. I waited a moment, then made my way round to the back of the caravan. When I touched its wooden side to steady myself, my hand came away wet with the cold dew. Anyone here? It's me, Flavia. I gave a light rap with my knuckles. There was a faint glow in the rear window, the sort of glow that might be given off by a lamp turned down for the night. Suddenly, something wet and horrid and slobbering touched the side of my face. I leapt back, my arms windmilling. Jesus! I yelped. There was a rustling noise and hot breath on the back of my neck, followed by the sweet smell of wet grass. Then Gry was nuzzling at my ear. Creakers, Gry, I said, spinning round. Creakers! I touched his warm face in the darkness and found it oddly comforting. Much more so than I should ever have guessed. I touched my forehead to his, and for a few moments, as my heart slowed, we stood there in the starlight, communicating in a way that is far older than words. If only you could talk, I thought. If only you could talk. Hello, I called again, giving Gry's muzzle one last rub and turning towards the caravan. But still there was no reply. The wagon teetered a bit on its springs as I stepped onto the shafts and clambered up towards the driving seat. The ornamental door handle was cold in my hand as I gave it a twist. The door swung open. It had not been locked. Hello? I stepped inside and reached for the paraffin lamp that glowed dully above the stove. As I turned up the wick, the glass shade sprang to light with a horrid, sticky red brilliance. Blood! There was blood everywhere. The stove and the curtains were splattered with the stuff. There was blood on the lampshade, blood on my hands. Something dripped from the ceiling onto my face. I shrank back in revulsion and perhaps a little fright. And then I saw the gypsy. She was lying crumpled at my feet, a black tumbled heap, lying perfectly still in a pool of her own blood. I had almost stepped on her. I knelt at her side and took her wrist between my thumb and forefinger. Could that thin stirring possibly be a pulse? If it was, I needed help, and needed it quickly. Mucking about would do no good. I was about to step out onto the driving seat when something stopped me in my tracks. I sniffed the air, which was sharp with the coppery metallic smell of blood. Blood? Yes, but something more than blood. Something out of place. I sniffed again. What could it be? Fish. The caravan reeked of blood and fish. Had the gypsy woman caught and cooked a fish in my absence? I thought not. There was no sign of a fire or utensils. Besides, I thought, she had been too weak and tired to do so, and there had certainly been no fishy smell about the caravan when I left it earlier. I stepped outside, closed the door behind me, and leapt to the ground. Running back to Buckshaw for help was out of the question. It would take far too long. By the time the proper people had been awakened and Dr. Darby summoned, the gypsy might well be dead, if she wasn't already. "Cry," I called, and the old horse came shuffling towards me. Without further thought, I leapt onto his back, flung my arms round his neck, and gave his ribs a gentle kick with my heels. Moments later, we were trotting across the bridge, then turning north into the leafy narrowness of the gully. In spite of the darkness, Gry kept up a steady pace, as if he were familiar with this rutted lane. As we went along, I learned quickly to balance on his bony spine, ducking down as overhanging branches snatched at my clothing, and wishing I'd been foresighted enough to bring a sweater. I'd forgotten how cold the nights could be at the end of summer. On we trotted, the gypsy's horse outdoing himself. Perhaps he sensed a hearty meal at the end of his journey. Soon we would be passing the tumbled-down residence of the Bulls, and I knew that we would not pass unnoticed. Even in broad daylight there were seldom travellers in the narrow lane. In the middle of the night, the unaccustomed sound of Gry's hoofs on the road would surely be heard by one of the half-wild Bull family. Yes, there it was, just ahead of us on the right. I could smell it. Even in the dark I could see the grey curtain of smoke that hung about the place. Spotted here and there about the property, the embers of the smouldering rubbish tips glowed like red eyes in the night. In spite of the lateness of the hour, the windows of the house were blazing with light. No good begging for help here, I thought. Mrs. Bull had made no bones about her hatred of the gypsy. Seizing a handful of Gry's thick mane, I tugged at it gently. As if he had been trained from birth to this primitive means of control, the old horse slowed to a shamble. At the change of pace, one of his hoofs struck a rock in the rutted road. "Shh," I whispered into his ear. "Tiptoe." I knew that we had to keep moving. The gypsy woman needed help desperately, and the Bulls was not the place to seek it. A door banged as someone came out into the yard, on the far side of the house by the sound of it. Gry stopped instantly and refused to move. I wanted to whisper into his ear to keep going, that he was a good horse, a remarkable horse, yet I hardly dared breathe. But Gry stood as motionless in the lane as if he were a purebred pointer. Could it be that a gypsy's horse knew more about stealth than I did? Had years of travelling the unfriendly roads taught him more low cunning than even I possessed? I made a note to think more about this when we were no longer in peril. By the sound of it, the person in the yard was now rummaging through a lot of old pots, muttering to themselves whenever they stopped the clatter. The light from the house, I knew, would cast me into deeper darkness. Better, though, to make myself smaller and less visible than a rider on horseback. I waited until the next round of banging began and slipped silently to the ground. Using Gry as a shield, I kept well behind him so that my white face would not be spotted in the darkness. When you're in a predicament, time slows to a crawl. I could not begin to guess how long we stood rooted to the spot in the lane. It was probably no more than a few minutes, but almost immediately I found myself shifting my weight uneasily from foot to foot and shivering in the gloom while Gry, the old dear, had apparently fallen asleep. He didn't move a muscle. And then the racket stopped abruptly. Had the person in the garden sensed our presence? Were they lying in wait, ready to spring, on the far side of the house? More time leaked past. I couldn't move, My heart was pounding crazily in my chest. It seemed impossible that whoever was in the Bulls' garden could fail to hear it. They must be keeping still, listening, as I was. Suddenly, there came to my nostrils the sharp reek of a safety match, the unmistakably acrid odor of phosphorus reacting with potassium chlorate. This was quickly followed by the smell of a burning cigarette. I smiled. Mrs. Bull was taking a break from her brats. But not for long. A door banged and a dark shape fluttered across behind one of the closed curtains. Before I could talk myself out of it, I began moving along the lane, slowly at first, and then more quickly. Gry walked quietly behind me. When we reached the trees at the far edge of the property, I scrambled up onto his back and urged him on.
"Dr. Darby's surgery," I said, "and make it snappy."
As if he understood. The surgery was situated in the high street, just round the corner from Cow Lane. I lifted the knocker, a brass serpent on a staff, and pounded at the door. Almost instantly, or so it seemed, an upstairs window flew open with a sharp wooden groan, and Dr. Darby's head appeared, his grey, wispy hair tousled from sleeping.
"The bell," he said grumpily. "Please use the bell."
I gave the button a token jab with my thumb, and somewhere in the depths of the house a muted buzzing went off.
"It's the gypsy woman," I called up to him. "The one from the fete. I think someone's tried to kill her."
The window slammed shut. It couldn't have been more than a minute before the front door opened and Dr. Darby stepped outside, shrugging himself into his jacket.
"My car's in the back," he said. "Come along."
"But what about Gry?"
I asked, pointing at the old horse, which stood quietly in the street.
"Bring him round to the stable," he said. "Aesculapius will be glad of his company."
Aesculapius was the ancient horse that had pulled Dr. Darby's buggy until about 10 years ago, when the doctor had finally caved in to pressure from patients and purchased a tired old bull-nosed Morris, an open two-seater that Daffy referred to as the wreck of the Hesperus. I hugged Gry's neck as he sidled into the stall with an almost audible sigh.
"Quickly," Dr. Darby said, tossing his bag into the back of the car.
A few moments later, we were veering off the high street and into the gully.
"The Parlings, you said?"
I nodded, hanging on for dear life. Once, I fancied I caught Dr. Darby stealing a glance at my bloody hands in the dim light of the instrument panel, but whatever he might have been thinking, he kept it to himself. We rocketed along the narrow lane, the Morris's headlamps illuminating the green tunnel of the trees and hedgerows with bounces of brightness. We sped past the Bulls' place so quickly that I almost missed it, although my mind did manage to register the fact that the house was now in total darkness. As we shot across the little stone bridge and into the grove, the Morris nearly became airborne, then bounced heavily on its springs as Dr. Darby brought it to a skidding halt just inches from the gypsy's caravan. Even in the dark, his knowledge of Bishop Lacey's lanes and byways was remarkable, I thought.
"Stay here," he barked. "If I need you, I'll call."
He threw open the driver's door, walked briskly round the caravan, and was gone. Alone in the darkness, I gave an involuntary shiver. To be perfectly honest, my stomach was a bit queasy. I don't mind death, but injury makes me nervous. It would all depend upon what Dr. Darby found inside the caravan. I shifted restlessly in the Morris, trying to sift through these rather unexpected feelings. Was the gypsy woman dead? The thought that she might be was appalling. Although Death and I were not exactly old friends, we did have a nodding acquaintance. Twice before in my life I had encountered corpses, and each one had given me...
"Flavia," the doctor was at the caravan's door. "Fetch a screwdriver. It's in the toolkit in the boot."
"A screwdriver? What kind of..."
It was perhaps just as well that my speculations were interrupted.
Quickly, bring it here. At any other time, I might have balked at his insolence in ordering me about like a lackey, but I bit my tongue. In fact, I even forgave him a little. As Dr. Darby began loosening the screws of the door hinges, I couldn't help thinking what remarkably strong hands he had for an older man. If he hadn't used them to save lives, he might have made a wizard carpenter.
"Unscrew the last few," he said. "I'll take the way to the door. That's it. Good girl."
Even without knowing what we were doing, I was his willing slave. As we worked, I caught glimpses of the gypsy beyond in the caravan's interior. Dr. Darby had lifted her from the floor to her bed, where she lay motionless, her head wrapped in surgical gauze. I could not tell if she was dead or alive, and it seemed awkward to ask. At last the door came free of the frame, and for an instant Dr. Darby held it in front of him like a shield. The image of a crusader crossed my mind.
"Easy now. Put it down here."
He manoeuvred the heavy panel carefully onto the caravan's floor, where it fit with not an inch to spare between the stove and the upholstered seats. Then, plucking two pillows from the bed, he placed them lengthwise on the door, before wrapping the gypsy in a sheet and ever so gently lifting her from the bunk onto the makeshift stretcher. Again I was struck with his compact strength. The woman must have weighed almost as much as he did.
"Quickly now," he said. "We must get her to the hospital."
So, the gypsy was alive. Death had been thwarted, at least for now. Pulling a second sheet from the bed, Dr. Darby tore it into long strips, which he worked swiftly into position under the door, then round and round the gypsy, fastening the ends with a series of expert knots. He had positioned her so that her feet were closest to the empty door frame, and now I watched as he eased past her and leaped to the ground outside. I heard the Morris's starter grind and then engage. The motor roared, and moments later I saw him backing his machine towards the caravan. Now he was clambering back aboard.
"Take this end," he said, pointing to the gypsy's feet. "It's lighter."
He scrambled past me, seized the end of the door that lay beneath her head, and began sliding it towards the doorway.
"Into the offside seat," he said. "That's it. Easy now."
I had suddenly seen what he was trying to do, and as Dr. Darby lifted the head of the door, I guided its foot down into the space between the passenger's seat and the instrument panel. With surprisingly little struggle, our task was finished. With the gypsy jutting up at a rigid angle, the little Morris looked like an oversized woodworking plane, the gypsy herself like a mummy lashed to a board.
"It isn't the neatest of arrangements," I remember thinking, "but it will do."
"You'll have to stay here," Dr. Darby said, wedging himself in behind the steering wheel. "There's not room for the three of us in the old bus. Just stay put and don't touch anything. I'll send the police as soon as I'm able."
What he meant, of course, was that I was in far less physical danger if I remained in one spot, rather than risking the possibility of flashing out the gypsy's attacker by walking home alone to Buckshaw. I gave the doctor a half-hearted